exploiting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we feature for the hour independent journalist Peter Byrne. In a series of articles over the past year, Peter Byrne has been looking at extremism. In one article from The New Scientist magazine, he asks about the anatomy of terror, what makes normal people become extremists. In another piece Peter Byrne published, on the origins of white nationalism. An hour with Peter Byrne on the Project Censored Show today. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we talk with independent journalist Peter Byrne. He's a Northern California-based, award-winning investigative journalist and has an uncanny ability to mine reportable nuggets of graft and corruption out of mountains of government and corporate records. Peter Byrne's recent pieces included Busted, Breast Cancer, Money in the Media, also Going Postal, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends. Cheap. Peter Byrne has won many awards over the years for his fantastic reporting, including one a few years ago from Project Censored. On today's program, we're going to talk about the anatomy of terror, what makes normal people become extremists. That will be the foreign element of our conversation, but we'll also bring it domestic by talking about the origins of white nationalism. Peter Byrne, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hi, Mickey.
So, Peter Byrne, you've, as usual, been very busy writing about fascinating things, and today we're going to focus on a couple of articles that you did, one from summer of 2017 and another very recent, both in The New Scientist or newscientist.com. The one from August 2017, you know, you've been writing about this topic for a while. This is called Anatomy of Terror, or Roots of Terror, as it is in the print edition. What makes normal people become extremists? And then the tagline for this, to give listeners an idea where you're going, it takes more than religious fanaticism or hatred to make someone take innocent lives, but recognize the true roots of ISIS-inspired terror, and they can be addressed. What brought you into writing about this specific topic? And again, you have a background too as a science writer.
I was reading the New York Times, of all things, which I never subscribed to. I always use Tor so I can get it for free. And it was reporting on ISIS in Iraq and Syria. This is about 2.5, 3 years ago. And I noticed that the territory that ISIS was controlling tended to flow along the Tigris and Euphrates River and major roadways, which reminded me of a network. And in network science, you talk about how certain nodes are more powerfully connected than other nodes, for example, and they're connected by edges, which in this case would be the rivers and the roads. And I was thinking, well, since ISIS is obviously such a bunch of bad guys, why aren't we like cutting these edges and isolating them? And I didn't know the answer. So I remembered after 9/11, I had interviewed this man at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey about terrorist networks, a man named John Arquilla. And he had now risen up to be the chair of the Department of Defense Analyses, a really connected dude in the Pentagon and all that kind of stuff. So I went down to Monterey and spent a couple of days there talking to these people that teach special operations, people like SEALs and Rangers and Green Berets, how to hunt terrorists. And it turns out that they use complex adaptive systems theory to try and figure out what to do, which is basically, people maybe used to know it as chaos theory. It's the attempt to kind of find patterns in any kind of turbulent data stream so that you can make some kinds of predictions on it. And what these guys, who were really embedded inside the military, academic, industrial science complex, war of terror complex, were telling me was we totally messed up. The war on terror is an awful mistake. We shouldn't even be attacking ISIS. We should not be bombing Mosul. It's going to all turn bad. And they, of course, turned out to be correct. I mean, Mosul is completely destroyed. So I started looking at it from a science point of view. And what I discovered was that there's a whole range of sciences from neurobiology and epidemiology and psychology and linguistics and physics and chemistry. Literally, almost every science you can think of, there's a terrorism focus somewhere in academia or in the private sector or in military-type organizations. And you don't read about this in the New York Times or anywhere, but inside this huge terrorism studies industry, which has just exponentially grown after 9/11, there's literally billions of dollars funneled into studying terrorism one way or another. You've got two kinds of focuses. You've got a kind of a linear focus, which is like, they're bad people, we should just go kill them, which reverberates back to creating more terrorists, of course, which is provable.
ISIS was not in Iraq prior to the invasion in 2003.
ISIS is a direct result of the destruction of the Iraqi socioeconomic infrastructure.
So this approach is create bad guys, get the bad guys, create more bad guys, and keep throwing money into that
cycle. And spends a lot of money. Like right now, Brown University's study shows that upwards of $6 trillion, which is bigger than the gross national product of the United States, has been spent on this war on terror, which is the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and all the counterterrorism so-called efforts that go with it, including drone strikes, and paying scientists and others to study the phenomena. So what happened to me was I began to see that there was all this scientific analytics around this. There wasn't much data because most of the data that is used for these studies, remarkably, tends to be drawn from English-only media sources. It turns out that most of the data, you know, you would think that we have this vast NSA satellite, you know, spying infrastructure, which we do, of course, but what that infrastructure is focused on is trying to find, quote-unquote, bad guys and kill them. There's no focus whatsoever inside that apparatus on looking at the root causes of what we call terrorism, which is actually really a tactic used by insurgencies. There's no such thing as a terrorist. There's no such thing as a terrorist philosophy. It's not a strategy. It's a tactic that is used from time to time by people that are generally fighting foreign invasions and the repression of local civil rights.
That's a pretty significant definition that you're giving us here.
There are officially almost 150 definitions of terrorism in the academic lexicon, as it were, all of them pretty much invented by institutions that are devoted to fighting terrorism. My own personal definition is that it is violence directed against civilians for political purposes, which includes, of course, states. But probably 99.9% of the definitions in use deliberately exclude states and focus only on what they call non-state terrorism, as if it's a thing, when it's actually just an expedient tactic that is used from time to time by people that are generally fighting to redress what they perceive to be grievances, you know, and generally those grievances are real, even though in the academic lexicon they always qualify it by saying perceived grievance. Because, you know, nobody really wants to solve this issue of the exponential growth of terrorism since 9/11. So back to the database situation, you've got all these people who are analyzing incident rate data, numbers of attacks based on English-only media reports. They don't check out the Russian media or the Arab press or anything that's not in English. And they build these databases and they confuse insurgent actions with terrorist-type attacks. And they have no database for counterterrorism. There is no database about the numbers of terroristic attacks on civilian populations mounted by the United States and its so-called coalition in Iraq and Afghanistan, Somalia, and about 60 countries around the world where we have special operations forces now working.
In fact, you quote Martha Crenshaw in your article, Roots of Terror. Crenshaw says, we don't even know what success might look like in this war on terror. And she likens it to a game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah, she says they pop up, we hit them on the head, and then we wait for the next one to pop up. But what I found was I talked to people like Wayne Porter, who used to be the chief of naval intelligence for the Middle East and then was the science advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's really into complexity theory type analyses. And he was saying that if we don't address the root causes of terrorism, we're going to end up not only bankrupting the United States economy, but we're going to annihilate our democratic values, such as they are. And I was being told time and time again that the official line that ISIS is evil and we must root them out is 180 degrees wrong, that actually we'd be much better off, and this was actually, I think, proven by what happened in Mosul and Raqqa, leaving a group like ISIS to evolve on its own. these horrible beheading public relations stunts that they pulled, evil as they are, were not their mode of operation. Public opinion polls actually showed that before and after ISIS was in charge of Mosul, they were popular in large segments of the population. In fact, they didn't seize Mosul in a day. It was over years. They built up a kind of presence, and then one day the Iraqi army ran away and they took over. So at any rate, as a journalist, I decided that if I was going to write about this, I needed to go talk to some people that were in the field and ask my new friends in the military how I could get to Mosul. The military itself was not allowing reporters to embed anymore. Not that I wanted to embed, but I wanted to not get killed either. And right. I figured walking around Mosul without an armed guard handy was probably like suicide, and I'm not into that. But what I did do was I found a young behavioral economist out of Harvard named Vera Mironova, who happens to be a Russian-American. And she was embedded with Iraqi special forces in Mosul, the so-called Golden Division, which was leading the fight against ISIS in Mosul. So I went to northern Iraq, to Kurdistan. I flew into Erbil and met up with Vera. And we drove to Mosul in January 2017 through numerous checkpoints, which she just flashed some pieces of paper she had from the Iraqi military, and they let her through. And we ended up arriving in Mosul right as the prime minister of Iraq was declaring that eastern Mosul was liberated from ISIS, east of the Tigris River, as it were. The west was the old city, which took another year for ISIS to be driven out of, mostly by pulverizing the city and tens of thousands of civilians that lived there. So I hung out with Vera and these Iraqi soldiers in their Humvee and with their guns, and most of them didn't speak English, so I had my smartphone, so-called, and used Google Translate, and we had some pretty hilarious conversations. And we had some pretty hilarious meals. At one point, they asked me if I would like to have pacha for breakfast. And we went to this restaurant in Mosul, which was about the only one open at that point. And they all ordered pizzas, and they ordered me a pacha, which happens to have been sheep brains and intestines stuffed with God knows what. And it was a very unappetizing, although probably a McDonald's would be equally unappetizing to an Iraqi point of view. And I ate it, and all these guys were staring at me. They were kind of disappointed. They said, oh, you must be special forces. It actually wasn't that bad. It was kind of tasty. The intestines were actually stuffed with rice. So about 2 days later, that suicide bomber went in there and blew up the whole restaurant. But hanging out with Vera, we would go into ISIS houses that had been recently abandoned. The ISIS cadre were either dead or captured. And the soldiers would look for intelligence material, you know, phone numbers, things like that, because they want to be able to track more people down and kill them. Vera was looking for anthropological stuff. You know, we were gathering up food wrappers. Turns out that ISIS likes Johnny Walker Red a whole lot, and they smoke Marlboros. And we also found diaries that Russian women who had married ISIS fighters had kept that were actually quite moving. In one of them in particular, this woman had written a letter to her husband, who was in the ISIS front line, talking about how they were going to meet in heaven after they were martyred. And then she scrawled the recipe of a type of cake that can only be made with a special kind of milk that you can get in Russia, and was hoping that she could find some in embattled Mosul. You know, so terrorist dream of comfort food too, as turns out. At any rate, all sorts of interesting anthropological stuff was gathered, and after that I left and got back into the United States just in time to see all the demonstrators at San Francisco International Airport protesting Trump telling the Iraqis that they could no longer come here, and, you know, the Muslim countries were banned from America and stuff like that. Actually, that started when I was in the refugee camps interviewing people outside of Mosul, and they were really, like, horrified that we would destroy their country and then tell them they couldn't come here to escape.
And there'd already been 5+ million refugees coming out of Iraq.
Yeah, and it was like close to 1 million coming out of the Mosul area that are still living in these horrible refugee camps, you know, partially run by the UN, partially run by the family that owns Kurdistan. And a lot of them can't go back to Mosul. one family that I interviewed in particular, ISIS had come to their house and they said, we're going to live in your house. You can live on the top floor. We're going to live in the bottom floor. And the guy was a welder. You have to weld stuff for us, like prison bars and things like that. Metal plate for suicide vehicles. And the guy did. He had three young kids, right? Which didn't mean that he was ideologically in tune with them. But during the battle, he managed to escape and they ended up in this camp. To my knowledge, he's still there. But they can't go back because his neighbor thinks that he's an ISIS person. And when people think you're an ISIS person in those types of circumstances, generally some kind of vigilante terrorism is executed upon you. So I wrote this article, The Roots of Terror, The Anatomy of Terror, for New Scientist. New Scientist actually sent me to Mosul to do this. They're a wonderful organization based in the United Kingdom, and they have an American staff as well.
Paying you to do actual investigative journalism on the ground where there are no other reporters.
No. Actually, no, there were corporate media. I ran into some New York Times photographers and people like that. They tended to be freelancers and stringers. There was some people from the mainstream media that were doing some pretty good stuff. In fact, I had my little video camera with me, and I sold a bunch of clips to Fox News, of all people.
No, I remember that Fox News was one of the places that had published something. Others didn't bite.
It's funny because Herb Beale is actually full of all sorts of freelance journalists, you know, and the trick is to get to the front line. So I happened to be in a great position because Vera was so thoroughly embedded and had all these documents that we could get through all these checkpoints. But a lot of reporters, you know, were little freelancers that were selling their wares for pittances to, right, you know, CNN or whatever, were just flocking around dead bodies trying to get the same story, you know. But nobody at all was looking at the context and at the roots of terror. As far as I know, you know, if you look at stuff that was coming out in the New York Times or the New Yorker, you know, they love to talk about ISIS people throwing gay guys off of towers and head chopping and evil this and evil that. But nobody talks about why they're doing it. You know, the New Yorker had this like 20-page article on atrocities, but no context whatsoever. So that's my goal, is to provide context. And in this particular case, you provide context by gathering data that actually is true. And then you analyze it, and you can use science to analyze it.
We're speaking with investigative journalist Peter Byrne. We're talking about an article that was published last year in New Scientist. It's at newscientist.com. The article is called Roots of Terror, and we will continue that conversation with Peter Byrne after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. We're joined today by award-winning investigative journalist Peter Byrne. We're talking about an article he did last year called Roots of Terror. In a little while, we're going to talk about a more recent article that you did and sort of connect things abroad with some of the things maybe happening here domestically. But let's cut to the chase here, literally. What are the roots of the terror that you saw when you were there? So what is it that the corporate media were missing?
I talked to any number of people in Erbil, which is a sister city to Mosul, which was not captured by ISIS. And they would tell me, we were happier under Saddam Hussein. You came in and you completely destroyed our country and turned it into a wasteland, and our economy is tanked, and we can't even sell oil anymore because your companies came in there and took all these production sharing contracts, which were unfair. So the roots are socioeconomic. The military types that actually do look at root causes will tell you time and time again that the major cause is people fighting insurgencies against a foreign invasion and people reacting to the repression of civil rights at a local level. It's local, local, local. So when the United States went in there and installed a Shiite government to take over from the previous Sunni-oriented regime of Saddam Hussein, the Shiites started to exterminate Sunnis. And to make a long story short, they fought back. And ISIS gradually emerged from that and completely liquidated the idea of national boundaries that had been instituted after World War I by the Sykes-Picot Agreement and moved into Syria, you know, saying that we're having a caliphate. We're not going to abide by these kind of imperialist mandated boundaries anymore. And that excited a lot of people, not just in the region, but obviously in Europe and even in America, where something upwards of 40,000 foreign fighters came there. A lot of the foreign fighters were ideologically driven. I think that a lot of the people in Iraq and Syria that ended up joining not just ISIS, but al-Nusra and a bunch of other insurgent groups with Islamist bent were more looking to have regular incomes, even if it was loot. And to escape enemies, you know, and if you're a Sunni and you're being pursued by the Shia, you want to join a gang, right? There's another element, too. I mean, Martha Crenshaw, who I talked to, is kind of the first person to really study terrorism starting back in the 70s from a scientific point of view. And she's famous for saying that terrorists are rational actors, which was a break with the previous conception, which was that all terrorists are psychopaths.
Yeah, crazy people.
She was saying that they actually have valid socioeconomic grievances, even if you don't agree with their methods of addressing them, which, you know, it's pretty hard to agree with somebody blowing up a bunch of school kids. But the United States does that with bombs all the time anyway, right? So what's the difference? Actually, I found something that went beyond Crenshaw's analysis, which is it was good at the time. But the more that the phenomena is studied, the more we see from a psychological point of view that even though the organizations themselves might be rational actors, they might be launching terrorist attacks against point X or point Y or this mosque or that army unit or that police station for tactical purposes in an insurgency, and that's rational kind of military thinking, that people that actually blow themselves up or that go and mass murder, you know, people with bombs and automatic weapons or even trucks are not like really normal. Give me a break. Killing people isn't like really the same thing to do, you know, right. Whether you're a terrorist or a counter-terrorist or a Navy SEAL or an ISIS member, you know. So I began to think, you know, what is it really going on here psychologically? Now, the thing with the Islamist variety of insurgent slash terrorists is that the kind of interviews that have been done with them generally have been after they've been captured, which they have very often a political point of view that they want to put across. They're not exactly going to tell you the truth. There's some cultural prohibitions against asking them about their childhoods and things like that. But as I was told by some very astute British researchers, the more that you talk to people that have blown up civilians, the more you find that they did it because they were really distressed that their own family had been blown up by the Americans or by the Shia. Now, is that a rational thing to do? Your family is blow up, so you go blow up somebody else's family? You know, not necessarily. So what makes a quote-unquote terrorist tick is the question. And here's the thing. You can strive to make a profile of a typical terrorist, so-called, but you can't. And people have been trying to do that for decades now, and they can't. Because all of the various qualities that you might say would drive a terrorist, socioeconomic grievances, perhaps not mental illness, but some kind of mental distress because of childhood sexual abuse or whatever, a lot of people that have those particular configurations don't commit terrorist acts. So why does a person that has the same kinds of characteristics that millions of other people have commit a terrorist act? It's all about context. They do it in a certain environment. There's a confluence of socioeconomic, environmental conditions with a personality that is predisposed in some way because of what's happened in their life, and it has happened politically around them to respond by killing innocent people.
So, Peter Byrne, another element here of this in terms of the way that the United States and other states have been dealing with terrorism, you know, we mentioned the whack-a-mole quote earlier. We mentioned the idea of creating terrorists and killing terrorists. But one of the offshoots of this, too, is to purportedly disrupt the networks, disrupt the terrorist networks. And one of the ways that we've seen that going on is by trying to shut down parts of the internet or censorship or combat misuse of the internet in ways that proliferate extremism. So that's that language, extremism, has been used. And here, Cass Sunstein in the United States under Obama, you know, looked into that. There are many other groups in the U.S. that are looking into this extremist rhetoric, and they're trying to close down sectors of the internet. So what can you say about this?
Well, they're never really going to close it down because the internet is like the primary lens by which the intelligence agencies find people to target with stings and make a big PR stink about. They've stopped terrorists in their tracks when generally they've approached people that otherwise wouldn't have done anything and given them the opportunity to sound off and then arrested them for basically not actually doing anything. On the other hand, there's a ton of data showing that most people are driven to join groups that engage in terrorism by friends and family. It's a camaraderie thing. You join a group that's engaged in violent extremism of various sorts, generally in the beginning, for safety or for companionship in a stressed out situation, which you might find in Iraq. Which brings us to the question of white nationalism.
There's another article that we want to get to here. So you just brought up white nationalism. This other article you did, Roots of Terror, was published last year. And now just in June 2018, you have another article here that's at newscientist.com on the origins of white nationalism. What motivates far-right extremism? Sociological studies are giving new insights and ways to tackle the phenomenon. And Peter Byrne, you then go and write about this. So coming from your experience in Iraq, how did that inform you, or did it at all, in terms of what you found here in particular extremist movements in the U.S.?
Well, what I was interested in was the psychology of people that are driven by socioeconomic and political circumstances to engage in, you know, violent extremism against otherwise innocent people, you know, civilians. And most of the jihadist types that are interviewed about those types of issues are in prison, and their interviews are biased in that regard. And you don't really, because of cultural phenomena, get into questions of, say, sexual childhood abuse and substance abuse and things like that. So I convinced New Scientist to send me to Orange County to interview former terrorists, Los Angeles Hammerskin types, Christian Identity people, people that in the 90s and the early aughts had actually engaged in viciously beating and sometimes murdering black people and Latinos and Mexicans and gay people. And in the epicenter of neo-Nazism and white supremacy that emerged in Orange County in the 70s as the previously purely pristine white suburbs were infiltrated by blacks and Asians. And I hooked up with a scientist at Chapman University named Pete Simi, who has probably done the most comprehensive analytics on the origins of white nationalist, neo-Nazi, violent extremism of anybody. He actually wrote a book called American Swastika that came out a couple of years ago, based on his embedding with a bunch of neo-Nazis in Orange County and elsewhere, to the extent that he would go to their parties celebrating Adolf Hitler, and he'd be in their houses when they had, for Christmas, they would have a swastika on the Christmas tree instead of a star. Their kids would have, like, coloring books, black people being lynched. They would look like otherwise normal suburban families, but they had this kind of culture going on, this safe space. And he also interviewed in a very scientific way, took the life histories of several hundred former white supremacist neo-Nazi types that had abjured their former violent ways, as well as people that were also active. And what he found was that probably 80% of the people he interviewed had sexual abuse and physical abuse growing up as children. They came from broken homes. They came from parents that had substance abuse problems. They themselves had substance abuse problems. So by the time they were in their teens, which is generally when people join up with skinheads and neo-Nazi type groups, they were already predisposed to act out their psychological predilections violently. And they would hook up with groups that gave them a sense of comradeship, and that also provided safety, because when you're living on the streets and you're going around randomly kicking people and worse, they join a skinhead group, for example, and then they become ideologically inculcated with the tenets of white supremacy. And time and time again, people who have studied white supremacists and neo-Nazi types in the United States are finding the same thing, that these are psychologically really damaged people. They're not necessarily psychotic. They're not like narcissists like, say, our president or Ted Bundy types, but they're people that have some serious issues, you know, personality disorders, that tend to flock together in these groups and then act out these problems that they had generally stemming from their childhood.
You talk in the article, too, about sociological research on extremists, and you mentioned that it's kind of difficult to really study what goes on in some of these groups. What do you do? Do you put out an ad and say, hey, we want to talk to some Nazis? Or
no, it's the kind of what they call a snowball effect. Mm-hmm. You find one person and they lead you to a series of other people, which is, from a scientific point of view, it's a little bit problematic because mm-hmm. you're supposed to have a randomized study, and it's not random at all, actually.
Yeah, right. But this is how you're getting insights from people that are part of this.
It's the only way to do it. you know, you can't advertise right. for violent extremists, Nazi lovers, and they're not going to flock around. So you also have to get permissions from your institutional review boards right. and your universities, which means that you're not going to cause harm to your subjects that you're interviewing. And Vera in Iraq had that in Premature, mm-hmm. and Pete Simi in Southern California also had that approval, and he didn't. A lot of it's anonymized, and the data is not used for, you know, intelligence or law enforcement purposes. It's used purely to find out what makes people tick.
And so in your estimation, you know, again, you wrote about the Charlottesville 2017 events and a whole slew of people that were talked to. What did you come away with, or what do you see any similarities, differences between what you were seeing when you were looking at people in ISIS?
There's a lot of similarities. I look at it as like two kinds of spectrums. If you have a spectrum of, say, psychosis to normality. So if you have a spectrum of mental health, and then you have a spectrum of grievances, from the grievances of, say, a white supremacist who thinks that knocking down Confederate monuments is a Jewish plot, to the grievance of, say, somebody in Iraq whose family was bombed by the United States and whose business was destroyed by the opposite religious ideology, you know, that's a real grievance. So you got a not very real grievance, and you've got a real grievance. And then you've got not too crazy, and then you've got really crazy. I think it's kind of an inverse relationship. The more crazy you are, the more likely you are to believe a not really true grievance. The less crazy that you are, the more logical and rational you are. You're going to believe one that's really true, like I'm being bombed and my entire country's right. being destroyed. How can I fight back?
Empirical evidence.
And terrorism is a weapon of people that don't have F-16s and atom bombs and things like
Powerless,
that. Because it's
right.
a political thing. Mm-hmm. You want to terrorize your enemies so that they stop terrorizing you. And interesting, what was found out in the Twitter stream around 2014 in the territory that ISIS seized in Iraq and Syria was that before the United States started bombing ISIS in 2014, the Twitter enemy was identified as the near enemy. It was the imam down the road, or the shopkeeper that was not bowing to Mecca often enough. But the minute that the bomb started to drop, the far enemy came into play, and that was the chatter about bombing people in Paris and in the United States mm-hmm. and Brussels and things like that. So the exporting of ISIS terror to the West was a direct result, data-driven and provable result of the United States bombing Mosul and Raqqa and the Syria.
So coming back here to the United States then, and on your studying of the white nationalist movements, in the state that that's in now, and again, it seems as if in the Trump presidency that, you know, sort of the mask has kind of come off of this, and we've seen more of this. Again, this is not new in our history per se, but we've certainly seen more visibly white nationalist movements, these kind of movements that are very intolerant. What is your idea, based on your research, how do you tackle that phenomenon? How do you get to the roots of this?
I think it's actually easier than the other phenomena, the jihadist phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I will refer to the ethnographer and sociologist Catherine Blee at the University of Pittsburgh, who mm-hmm. I interviewed for this article in New Scientist about white nationalism. Blee actually has embedded with white nationalist neo-Nazi women over the decades. When we talked about the roots of white nationalism, she stated very clearly that it was racism in America. In our society, racism is embedded into the society. It's embedded into the culture. It's been here for hundreds of years. As the Trump phenomenon show, it didn't really go away after the civil rights movement. It was just waiting to pounce. And it's metastasizing now. So if you have in your culture a kind of racist status quo, even unconscious racism, if a bell curve of racism in America has a mean value, then on the tails of the curve, on the out, you're going to have outliers who are going to be violent, perhaps terroristic. So her suggestion is, if we want to get to the roots and solve the question of white nationalism and violent extremism, including Christian identity, anti-abortion clinic attacks and things like that, murders, then we have to adjust our thinking in our own culture. We have to actually develop and evolve a society and a culture in which racism is not acceptable, and then the outliers will gradually go away and we should be treated as a criminal problem, which also, in my opinion, applies to the question of international jihadist terrorism. Mm-hmm. That is a criminal problem, not a problem that requires an entire Western society to mobilize a multi-trillion-dollar war based on fear and the profits of Lockheed Martin.
Yeah. And would you argue that education is some way that it's possible to get? I mean, look, we've had education for ages. We've gradually, certainly in the last 50 years, had education about race, about structural racism, sexism. And in fact, we have whole movements basically come out of this to try to address, to do what you said, to try to, when people are committing crimes, they're committing crime.
There's something else, Mickey, that ties it all together besides the psychological aspect. Now, this ties together white nationalism, neo-Nazi type thinking, Christian identity type thinking with Islamist jihadist types of movements. And that is neoliberal globalization. It's inequality driven. It's poverty is well known not to be a driver of insurgency and terrorism. It's inequality and repression that are the drivers. So in the United States, there is a tremendous amount of economic and social inequality, and that is driving the racist movement. In the Middle East and Indonesia, where you have Islamist insurgent terrorist types of organizations and movements, it is also driven by the inequalities between the ruling elites and the masses of the people. Because people that engage in political terrorism and insurgency, they're not actually, from their own points of view, doing it because they just want to blow up people. They consider themselves to be altruists, and in many ways they are. They are speaking for masses of people through a lens that can only be appreciated if you're there on the ground. And I have to add that from white nationalist terrorist types organizations to jihadist type terrorist organizations, none of them act without mass bases. They have to have mass bases. There are people, millions of people, that support these movements because they are the only political antidote to the depredations of neoliberal globalization, which is coming in, extracting resources through military force and the brutality of capitalist exploitation.
And in these two articles, you're getting at, this is something that is going on abroad, but it's also happening here, of course, domestically.
It's global. That's why they call it globalization. And, you know, globalization, you know, ever since the meltdown of 2008, it's gotten stronger and stronger and stronger with the gap between the haves and the have-nots, as we've seen in this country, which is basically run by Goldman Sachs, right? So it's not like totally out of line that your person on the streets who's got some issues is going to be attracted to the idea that Jews are running the world and that therefore we should kill them all, or that the blacks are trying to muddy up our otherwise pristine race. We saw this happen in Hitler's Germany. We're seeing it happen now in Eastern Europe, in Poland and elsewhere, in Germany itself and in England. You know, there's a tremendous resurgence of this weird mix of plutocracy and populism that Trump embodies, which the new leader of Italy embodies, where the immigrants that are being expelled as refugees from the war on terror's horrors in the Middle East are being turned away from Western countries and told to go drown. There's no recognition that the people that are boat people in the Mediterranean are there because of the war on terror.
Chase Palmieri here.
Peter, I have a question for you. I'm wondering how much of this is a generational thing. If enough time passes, that the problem of white nationalism will fade into the history books, or are there young people today who are grasping at these ideologies?
Oh, you've seen the alt-right. I mean, those people were all pretty much young. There's a pool of disaffected white youth that's always been drawn on for decades by these types of organizations, and I see no evidence that that's going away. I think it's getting stronger. And if you look at, like, say, White Rabbit Radio, there's a tremendous amount of online materials, including like the six-hour movie of Adolf Hitler, which is like the true story of Adolf Hitler, painting him as a pretty nice guy. There's a huge, easily accessible body of validation that you're okay as a white person and it is targeting the youth. In fact, there's a lot of similarities between jihadist-type propaganda in music, Islamist rap, and music videos with what is coming out of the white supremacist movement. I mean, you had bands back in the day, back in the 90s, like Skinhead. White power rock was a huge draw for the youth, and that's actually not maybe as strong right now as the little vortices and pathways of racist kind of attacks on multiculturalism that aren't quite as pointed as, you know, Skinhead might have been, but which are targeting this notion that there's no reason that our race should be diminished, giving people affirmative action, which is taking away from us as if it was a zero-sum game.
Well, you see this with Richard Spencer. You see this with a lot of the neo-Nazi types claiming they're not Nazis, claiming that they're even not racist.
No, they're for freedom of speech.
Right. So it's a very strange and Orwellian twist. What do you think then is to be done about this issue here in the United States?
I'll start with the issue of jihadist insurgency and terrorism. That very clearly can be ameliorated and allowed to devolve and probably go away over a period of time if we stop attacking people's countries and taking their stuff. If we turn neoliberal globalization based on austerity and harming people into something that was more positive, like maybe a socialist type approach, which, you know, actually on paper looks pretty good. And here we need to have a society in which the president of the United States is not allowed to broadcast in the media the kind of racist tripe that this man has been promoting every day for 3 years now. That is CNN and the New York Times and the people that amplify his vile tweets are responsible for creating this culture in which you're going to find people that are willing to pick up bombs and guns to kill what they call MUDs.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Peter Byrne, and we'll also bring his son into the conversation, Miles Byrne, as he accompanied his father to a recent conference on terrorism and counterterrorism. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's show, we've been speaking with Peter Byrne. He is a Northern California-based award-winning investigative journalist. A few of his recent exposés include Busted, Breast Cancer, Money in the Media, as well as Going Postal, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends. Cheap. On this program, we've been focusing on Peter Byrne's more recent work, published at NewScientist.com. and New Scientist magazine. One is Anatomy of Terror, What Makes Normal People Become Extremists. And Peter Byrne, of course, says, well, it takes more than religious fanaticism or hatred to make someone take innocent lives, but recognize the true roots of ISIS-inspired terror, and they can be addressed. We're also speaking with him about his article on the origins of white nationalism. Peter Byrne, before the break, you were going back and forth, in fact, between war on terrorism abroad as well as what we're seeing in terms of extremism at home. And we did start making mention of what role the media play in the portrayal of these groups. So I figured, given the Project Censored Show, we often talk about media and media analysis. And of course, you've done your own fair share of media criticism as a journalist. What are your thoughts on the issue of media and how these topics are being both presented and how you think maybe the media is not doing these topics justice?
Well, the so-called war on terror, the long war, is obviously a profit center for the major mainstream media. Not only does terrorism ISIS style with beheadings or Timothy McVeigh style with blowing up federal buildings increase ratings greatly when they occur, so people can sell. So they generate mass feelings of fear and anxiety, which is why terrorism works. And so even though the risk of actually being killed by a so-called terrorist is almost vanishingly small, we see our group threatened. So it works. And the media knows that. what is largely missing from the media reports on the so-called war on terrorism, which is the global war over the last 18 years, has been any voice of dissent from the scientific community, which is what I report upon in both of my New Scientist articles and in an upcoming book. The scientists originally, and I've interviewed hundreds of them, many of them were mobilized by the events of 9/11 to start using their science, whether it was neurobiology or psychology or physics or, you know, easily 20 or so disciplines, even including philosophy, to take a look at terrorism and what it is and what it is not and what works or doesn't work to ameliorate it. And what I found is that not only are scientists that are embedded within the military-industrial complex structure and in academia increasingly coming to the conclusion that the war on terror is the cause of terrorism, but people inside the military, advisors to Joint Chiefs of Staff, captains and colonels in the intelligence community, former Navy SEALs that are engaged in counterterrorism activities in Iraq and Afghanistan, have been telling me over and over and over again that every time we go and kill people in villages or with drones or ruin someone's economy, which is what these wars have been doing, or steal their resources, which is what these wars have been doing because they are wars, we create new generations of terrorists to replace the people that we kill because we kill their fathers and their uncles.
Interesting, Peter Byrne, that Noam Chomsky, in the many books he's written on the issue of terrorism, and especially since 9/11, he's basically said, in his estimation, the best way to decrease terrorism or to help eradicate the problem of terrorism is to simply stop participating in it.
Absolutely, and I would concur, and I think that the interesting thing about my research is that now a huge proportion of people that study terrorism from a scientific basis or from the point of view of political science would also concur with him. Now, they may not want to say the words Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, right.
But they're saying the same things. And I found that even inside the Pentagon, I heard high-ranking people that study this in great detail saying the same things because they're fed up with the bloodbath and with the loss of what they call treasure. So when you look at the grievances of people in Iraq and Afghanistan, they always go back to the fact that we attacked their countries and destroyed their countries. You hear time and time again now at the highest levels of American government, well, we can't allow Iraq to break up into three separate nations. It's got to be one nation. Well, it was one nation when we attacked it. Regarding the Taliban, they say, we can't leave Afghanistan because then the Taliban will win. Well, they're winning. It's been 17 years. So it's not rational that we keep doing this. Now, in an attempt to kind of unravel what's rational and what's not rational, I recently got a grant to organize a conference at UC Davis with Jim Crutchfield, who's a very renowned statistical physicist and complexity theorist. He's kind of legendary. And we gathered a bunch of scientists together for one day and had everybody make small presentations, and then we had a lot of talking back and forth on how can we define this problem of the relationship of counterterrorism to terrorism, where counterterrorism causes terrorism and terrorism causes feedback loop to cause counterterrorism. It's this kind of self-replicating loop. How do we interfere with that? And the point is that a lot of people that have the analysis that counterterrorism causes terrorism have no traction inside the White House or at the upper levels of the Pentagon or in Congress, which is run by the military-industrial Lockheed Martin, et cetera, complex. So the result of this conference, and these people are some of them have worked for years with the Pentagon, is that we can no longer do that sort of top-down organizing. We have to start doing a bottom-up type of organizing and getting out the word to normal people through whatever means that we can that counterterrorism causes terrorism. And then if we want to understand and stop terrorism, we have to first look in the mirror. And then we have to do things that may be seemingly distasteful, but in the long run would solve all sorts of problems, which is rethink and stop the kind of neoliberal austerity program, country-destroying globalism, so-called globalism that we've been exporting ever since Ronald Reagan. Rethink going in and stealing people's resources and using military force to annihilate entire cultures in a war which, you know, really is in many ways, like it or not, a war against the Muslim world, because all the countries that we attack happen to be pretty much Muslim, and that's how they view it. So we need to actually be honest and start taking a look at this and deciding, you know, what's in our real interest if we want to continue to have the occasional terroristic attack in New York and the daily terrorist attacks in countries that we've occupied, then we're going to have to stop the type of imperialist economics and militarization that we're doing that is actually also ruining the American economy.
Peter, this is Chase Palmieri. You just mentioned how the U.S. government keeps moving the goalposts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm wondering, since you've been in Mosul and you've been abroad there, what is the best argument you've heard in favor for why the U.S. should still be in both of those countries?
I've not heard a good argument for that. There is no good argument for that. I mean, when I talk to ordinary people in Kurdistan, in Erbil and in Mosul, they were saying, you know, we were better off under Saddam Hussein. We hated him, but we were better off. Why don't you guys just leave? You know, there's the question that's always held out, well, maybe the World Bank and the IMF can invest in the buildings that we just blew up and you can have new ones. Well, that doesn't go very far. Just ask the people in Bosnia or Panama City. I mean, who wants the foreigners to own everything? And that's essentially what has happened in Iraq. Foreign capital, especially the oil companies, have made a lot of headway. They haven't been able to grasp everything that they wanted. They ran into difficulties because the Russians also came in and stepped into some gaps, and so did the Chinese. And they've been making pretty significant fossil fuel types of deals with disaffected Kurds and other factions. So actually, I think that, you know, the pottery barn thesis that Colin Powell so famously made before they invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and destroyed these vibrant, beautiful cultures, which, if you broke it, we got to fix it. Well, actually, that's an insane formulation. If it's broken and you broke it, you can't fix it. The best thing you could do is to dump about $90 trillion on the table and walk away and say, I'm sorry, I'll never come back. Well, I'm going to go home and think about what I did and apologize and try to educate my populace not to do such terrible things in the future, which there may be a lot of people in America that would like to do that. So the question is, how do we reach them? They need information. And that information, from my kind of crusade, if you will, in regard to this, is to use information that comes out from the inside of the system by hard-nosed scientists and military specialists, including some Navy SEALs that were embedded in the high parts of the counterintelligence circles, is to just walk away from it. Just stop. Nobody has ever really thought that ISIS, for example, or the Taliban were an existential threat to the United States. Those people can't destroy the United States. But we can destroy the United States by trying to continually destroy them.
Indeed, Peter Byrne. That's what Chalmers Johnson said in the Blowback trilogy. That's, again, what Noam Chomsky's been saying for years. Interesting allies, however, that you're talking about many people that are expert within the system that are part of the military-industrial complex or the national security complex, and you're saying intellectually that their arguments appear to mirror those on the left.
At the UC Davis conference, we had two retired Navy SEALs, one of whom was in charge of science at the National Counterterrorism Center until he recently retired, and another does consulting in the private sector on these issues. These guys spent a number of years after the invasions leading SEAL teams in to annihilate people in villages. They have blood on their hands. And they told me that it didn't work, that every time we killed somebody, we created 10 people that hated us. So now they're actually, both of them have some scientific backgrounds, very keen on using complex adaptive system theory to model this so that we can show, not just mathematically, but logically, and in language that people can understand, that every time that we do what it is that we've been doing for the last 17 years, which is a definition of insanity, of course, we're making the problem even worse. And we have to radically rethink what we're doing.
So if you're saying that counterterrorism abroad leads to more terrorists, does that mean that the U.S. shouldn't try to do any counterterrorism to the white supremacists within our own country because it would lead to more white supremacy?
No, I think that the solution path there is a bit different. As I mentioned earlier in the program, the violent extremism of the far right, if you look at it like in a bell curve there on the outliers, it's going to be there as long as there's a medium of racism in the culture, which there is in America and always has been. As long as there is kind of this unconscious and conscious racism embedded in our culture, which is now getting, you know, more and more attention because it's being the fascists in the White House likes it, you're going to have those kind of people on the outliers. So it doesn't do much good to attack them because that just makes them stronger. And that's another lesson of counterterrorism in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in America. When you attack them, it makes them more resilient, which is because it's easier for them to disperse and reorganize and survive to fight another day, whereas a big lumbering, you know, Goliath can't do that. So if you want to reduce far-right terrorism in America, you have to not only reduce the cultural racism that is the foundation of our culture, but the same thing about neoliberal globalization applies. We need to completely reverse our imperialistic global projects and start reinventing our system of government and economics. Imperialist capitalism doesn't work. It's led us to this. It has clearly failed. We are a failed state here in the United States. So Let's look for something different. Now, you know, people say, well, there isn't anything different. Look at communism and socialism. They failed everywhere they've been tried. And, you know, the answer to that is, yeah, they failed because capitalism came back, you know. I mean, anarchistic type programs have gone some distance too, but capitalism came back. So let's acknowledge those failures and not get caught up in a lot of metaphor baiting around that, but think logically about what it would mean to take profit out of the command of the American economy and put it on a basis where everybody can have a job, everybody can have a place to live, everybody can have an education, everybody can have access to health care. What would that look like? And of course we could do it. Hunter-gatherers were doing this 10,000 years ago. We've slid down since then, unfortunately.
We're speaking with independent journalist Peter Byrne. You can learn more about Peter Byrne's work at peterbyrne.info. That's B-Y-R-N-E. We've been talking about two of the articles that Peter published at thenewscientist.com online. You can see them. Anatomy of Terror, What Makes Normal People Become Extremists, is one from August of 2017. You can also see one from June this year. It is called On the Origins of White Nationalism. So it's also the case, Peter Byrne, that the conference that you were doing at UC Davis, you brought your son, Miles Byrne, who's 15 years old. Miles Byrne, you're here in the studio with us today, and I'm very curious to learn, what did you think of the interactions that were going there? What did you learn when you were at the conference?
The conference consisted of people from all sorts of academic disciplines, from sociology, from history, from the math department, from physics, and they pretty much were unanimously in agreement that the solution to terrorism, insofar as, you know, the various disciplines could tell, was to not be present where it was happening, was to not exacerbate, you know, the wound that they had already caused. And the Navy SEAL guys, who were the people that were, you know, embedded in the counterterrorism industry, which is absolutely massive, had spent long enough floundering out there and had returned back saying that they realized that they were not getting anywhere with what they were doing. They had no clear objective. They did not have strategy. They were simply pouring military might into a place where military might had done nothing to reduce the damage that the people who had been radicalized were causing. And whenever you have someone who's growing up in a society that has been torn apart by an extraneous or exterior influence, it's like, you know, the young people there, they don't know how to respond to this, right? I mean, the political, moral, and emotional infrastructure has been just totally altered. You know, it's never been able to settle down and reach a solid point. So there's no comforting society that they can grow up around.
Well, Miles, as being a young person yourself, do you talk with people in your peer groups, you know, about these things, about these experiences? Do you talk about these kind of topics and subjects, and equally talk about them in the way that you just expressed, right? You were talking about what would it be like for young people to be growing up in these war-torn places. I mean, is this something that you talk to people here in the U.S. about?
Occasionally, not as much as I would like to. I think that there's a great deal of misinformation regarding terrorism. The media, which is a huge player, as you guys have mentioned again and again, and, you know, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers.
They're good at that.
Yeah, that's their job.
Framing. Thank you very much for coming on the program today, Miles.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. The program was established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm also the executive producer of the program. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers include Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. All the programs are archived online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and other social media. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies. alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in.